sincere honor to have you come share what you teach normally at Emory. I will just turn our series over to you, and you can tell us about our handout and whatever else we need to know.
Okay, thank you, Jean Ellen. This is April 15th, 2012, isn't it? And so this is the beginning of the Quran, Bible, Islam, and Christianity class. And as some of you may know, I'm Vernon Robbins and regularly teach at Emory University. And I'm very happy to be here to talk with you about the Bible and the Quran and Islam and Christianity. And you see the sequence of the sessions there on the first page on the handout. Next week, Abbas Barzagar will be here. He got his, well, he grew up in Yemen. He's Muslim. And then went to, Arizona State, which has a very strong Muslim program in Islam. Got a master's there, and then came to Emory University and got a PhD in the graduate division of religion. And he came to me at one point and said, could I be your teaching assistant in the New Testament? And I said, I'd love to have you. You're a very bright young man. He said, I really don't know that much about the New Testament, but I'd like to learn by being your teaching assistant, if you do it. I said, well, that's great. I said, what you can do is create the quizzes for the students on the basis, and then I can see what you are learning and what you are noticing as well. And so he did a beautiful job, and the students just loved him. He's wonderful. And he teaches here at Georgia State. And he was going to come April 29th when I have to be in California, Santa Barbara, to give a paper. And he said, finally, he wrote me just 3 weeks ago or so and said, well, on April 29th, I have an opportunity to either be in Morocco or to be at Duke University. And he says, I have to accept one. I haven't decided which I'm going to accept. And I said, well, Abbas, do it. Do it. Yeah, do it. I said, famous last words, I said, I'll find someone. Well, I've been looking. I have two names of people, and God willing, inshallah, I'll find someone, because Gina and your note helped, and so we can arrange that. Then I'll be back, inshallah, on May 6th. And do have a session on the Quran and Jesus, John the Baptist. Yahya is John the Baptist's name in the Quran. Mary and the Lord's Prayer. Lord's Prayer in relation to the opening Al-Fatiha in the Quran. Maybe some of you know about that, maybe not. So we'll have a session on that. Then on May 13th, the Quran and the Gospels of Luke and John. That's something very special to my heart, because it's something that I discovered working with the Quran that was a real surprise to me. I'll share with you. And then the 20th, the Quran and John 17, the high priestly prayer, it is, as it is called in John. You see the map of Saudi Arabia. I thought we should have a little map. And just to put things in proportion here a little, you see the words Amman and Jordan up here in the northeast corner, okay? And then if you look carefully, you'll see a little strip of land up there. That's Israel. And that is very big in our news, you know. And look at it geographically. And it can help to explain anxiety within Israel as well. You talk about being surrounded. You talk about being small. And so here is Israel. Then you see Saudi Arabia, the major place that I want to talk about just for a moment. And then notice directly above Saudi Arabia, Iraq, ancient Babylonia, okay, from which Abraham came. Okay, so he was born and raised. We'll talk about that. And then Iran, ancient Persia. Okay? And the Persians owned all of this, had conquered all of this area and ruled over Israel 400 to 300. And it's in that context. context that the emphasis on God of darkness, God of light, came out of the Persian region. There was Zoroastrianism. And the question is, how much Iranian influence was there on apocalypticism in Judaism that has a strong throughout? But now, if you look in Saudi Arabia, you'll see, you go down here to Mecca, where Muhammad was born and raised. And then, after Muhammad lived in Mecca and established a community there, then they had the Hijra, the northern exile movement up to Medina, the ancient city of Yathrib, where Muhammad then set up major leadership.
Excuse me, just a minute, Cheryl. We have a seat over here.
Yeah, I'll sit over there. Okay. Do you have any more of these? We'll play for
you. There are 15, so please share with one another. I think there's no problem in this room the way love abounds. Just find a friend and.
Why don't we put one over there?
Here you go. Okay. Okay, to get ourselves positioned a little bit, just to try to think, to get Islam in perspective a bit. After Jesus' death and resurrection, around 30 of the Common Era, the really big event in early Christianity was the Jewish-Roman Wars from 66 to 70, in which, as you see on the sheet, in 70 AD, then, the Jerusalem Temple and Jerusalem itself was burned and ravaged and destroyed by the Roman army. Okay? Now that was a major event, really, for the success of Christianity, in the view of many historians. Hi, Cheryl. In the view of many historians, the great interruption of Jewish history with the destruction of the Jerusalem Temple and Jerusalem itself created a context for the real birth of Christianity. Christianity was able to argue that the destruction of Jerusalem was related to the destruction of Jesus. Okay. And that the destruction of Jerusalem created a context in which the sacrificial benefits and the sacrificial focus shifted from Jerusalem to Jesus. And this created a context in which all four Gospels in the New Testament focus on Jesus' death in Jerusalem after, at some point in his life, either early in his life or just before the final events, Jesus had gone into the temple and had criticized the activity there. And in the Gospel of John, it talks explicitly about the destruction of the temple and then the raising up of Jesus' body there. So 70 is an absolutely crucial event in the birth of Christianity, so that from that time on, we began to really get two streams of Judaism. There's one being the Messianic stream, Christianity, that moved to the West. This is your West, up toward Rome, and the other stream, the Pharisaic stream with the Rabbinic stream, that really gained its strength by establishing and reestablishing its strength from Israel to the east to Babylonia, where they had had Babylonian exile. So you get the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud with Hebrew, Aramaic remaining the major languages, and the Christians in this eastern region then begin to write Aramaic in script. And so Syriac is a major Christian language in the East, in what we regularly call kind of Jewish Christianity. While the kind of Christianity we know will use the Greek language, which is the lingua franca there, and went west through Asia Minor, modern Turkey, Macedonia, Greece, and to Rome. So we know Western Christianity. And I tell you this story because one of the difficulties we Christians have in trying to deal with the biblical stories in the Quran and talking with Muslims is that the kind of Christianity that is known in Islam is Eastern Christianity. These heretical branches of Christianity that believe in Jesus' one nature. They tend to be monophysite rather than the dual nature, the two natures, which was decided at Nicaea, where it was decided that Jesus was fully human and fully divine, both. So there are many traditions in the East, including the influence of an early thinker named Marcion, who first of all thought that Christians should not have the Old Testament, but just have the New Testament, one gospel, the Gospel of Luke, and letters of Paul should be the heart of the gospel. And then in this eastern area also, we had ascetic Christians who did not eat meat, and thought that through a process of removing the physicality of the human body, a person became more and more divine-like. And so you had ascetic monastics living in the desert here in this area, and down in the Egypt there's a very, very symbiotic relationship between Saudi Arabia and Egypt here, with emphasis on the human body as it withers is becoming more and more divine through synergy, working with God. This is a term you will hear in Eastern Orthodox Christianity, where the human needs to work with God and with the co-creative powers of humans and the divine. One can move through a process of deosis, of becoming divine. Augustine, using things in Paul, really established a counter view of that for the West, where he argued that flesh is so sinful internally itself that it is not able to be a co-creator with God. But the only answer for the West is grace that can come in and pronounce that sin not present by God. God makes human beings righteous because they cannot, by their powers at all, move beyond this righteousness, etc. Now, in Islam, the view is very much more Eastern Christian-like. So that one of the things people ask me, well, is there a concept of grace in Islam? The term grace never occurs in the Quran. Well, in essence, I would argue there is a very strong actual concept of grace through God's mercy. And through God's mercy is just so great and overpowering and so forgiving that praying to God through God's mercy enables and energizes the believer to be righteous, and to enter into God's creative powers. And in Islam, God is so great that creation is no problem at all. God created the entire heavens and earth and everything that was in 6 days, and it was such an easy thing, he didn't even have to rest on the seventh day. Easy. So there is no Sabbath day in Islam. And they say, whoa, what do we mean by that? Well, this is a tribute to God. God is so easy. And resurrection, easy thing. Every year, God causes things to die, brings them back to life, and God doesn't even get tired. just the easy thing. So, resurrection of Jesus, no problem. But the issue is, did Jesus really die? Well, here in the East, we will see the strong influence of the Gospel of John. If Jesus has eternal life in him, is there any real possibility of killing Jesus? It may look like you've killed him. Have you really killed him? And so this is a big issue for Christians with Islam, but I will talk a little bit about a book called Acts of John, where as Jesus seems to be dying on the cross, this is Acts of John, the John who is perceived to have written the Gospel of John. And while Jesus is dying on the cross, John flees up to a cave. While he's in the cave, it's a bright shining light, and Jesus starts speaking to him. This is a Christian document in the East. And Jesus says to John, "Now, they think I'm dying down there on the cross. I am dying, but I'm alive. Okay? Because I die and I live. Okay? Because I am the Word, I am bread, I am the shepherd, I am all of these things." This is Eastern Christianity, which is much more mystical, much more oriented toward God as a being, totally all-powerful, all-knowing, all-wise, beyond any human being. So then here comes another problem. To call God Father is to limit God. That is a really strange thing, to try to say that God would be a father, because God is so beyond fatherhood. And then to say that God has a son, that is just really, really not appropriate, because God is not involved in any kind of generative process that has any kind of sexual connotation or limitation like that. Because God simply said, be, sent that word be from the angel Gabriel to Mary, and Jesus was in Mary's womb. And God did the same thing with Adam. He simply said, be, and Adam was. Okay? So this is how powerful God is. All right? How do we get accustomed to that? Well, if you're into a deeper kind of mysticism, a deeper praise and adoration of God's incredible, infinite, beyondness, why then you can begin to understand some of the sentiment in Islam. And we will talk more about this later. But how do we get there? Well, look, the destruction of the Jerusalem temple started in 70. Christianity then existed 500 years before the birth of Muhammad. He is born in 570. Okay? 500 years is quite a long time. We'll talk just a little bit more about that when we turn the page. But notice that Muhammad married at age 25, married a very wealthy, well-to-do businesswoman, very smart thing to do. She supported him, so then every year he could go out and he could spend a month out thinking about things by this mountain nearby. And at age 40, he started receiving revelations during the month of Ramadan. Now, why age 40? and what's the effect? Well, age 40 is when a Muslim male really becomes a man. He really enters adulthood. Those are the men to whom you need to listen. They are wise, okay? And this brings, this leads to the whole tradition of the imams in Islam, and the special focus on them as the ones who really know what the Quran says, who really knows how to use the Quran and all of the sunnah and all of the Sharia law to decide very complicated cases. And in the context of some language, it comes out of the Old Testament, like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It's a biblical tradition. Imams for 300 to 400 years would decide that never would anyone's hand be cut off, or that would they be killed. Okay, but what happened with especially with the fight against communism in Afghanistan, the West started to support the most radical religious groups, the military religious groups. And the military religious groups began to uproot the imams and only allow imams to stay in power who were the radical imams. Okay? And so we have seen a deep, deep disruption of the long traditions of what you would call moderation, etc. True, back in the 19th century already, we began to have conservative movements within Saudi Arabia and Egypt, etc. Like we have seen here in the United States, it was the 1900 we began to see fundamentalism and really conservative backlash against Darwin, evolutionism, etc., etc. And so we've gone through, first of all, the 20th century looked like it might be kind of holding its own, moving into more liberating kinds of modes during the 60s, and then the 70s hit, and the 70s and the 80s have seen a resurgence of extreme conservatism in Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and even within Buddhism. We see this. So we've had a real deepening of conservatism. One of the ways in which that is done is disrupting the men over 40 who are attacked as conservative guys who won't move out and who won't decide, you know, to link up with the West and with, you know, with iPhones and tape recorders and TVs, etc. So it's a long story. But in 610 then, Muhammad started giving revelations of that had been given to him by the angel Gabriel. Okay, and here just a little insight into angels. Yeah? Angel Gabriel was around during the time of Daniel. And then Angel Gabriel came to Mary. And now the Angel Gabriel comes to Muhammad. No problem. No problem. Remember, angels are eternal. Yeah? So what's 500 years? What's 1,000? No problem. So the angel Gabriel is there. And Angel Gabriel, of course, is the one who came to Mary and brought the word be to Mary so that Jesus was in the womb, is the same one who comes to Muhammad and has new revelations. Okay? And so Muhammad is given revelations that presuppose the stories in the Hebrew Bible, presuppose the stories in the New Testament. But now you don't have to tell all those stories. What you do is summarize the updating of those stories. And where does the updating come from? Eastern Christians and Eastern Jews. Okay? So by this time, Jews have the Talmud, they have Haggadah, they have all kinds of stories about Abraham, Moses, about, you know, when Moses went up in the heavens and God was teaching the Torah and Moses was sitting in the back seat, you know, and what is all this? And they say, yeah, you never did understand the Torah, you know. And so the others have it. And they have all these stories, and we'll look at one of the stories about Abraham, but also the Eastern Christians have stories. Now, I mean, you know the time, right, when Jesus made little clay birds and brought them to life. You know that, right? Right? You don't? You know? Well, it's in the infancy gospel of Thomas. Why don't you know it? Everybody knows it in the Eastern Church. Because there hadn't been any Reformation yet by Protestants who said, you shouldn't read all of Christian literature. You should simply read the Bible. You know? So they have all this extra Christian literature, and this is what they know and build upon. And then Christians are fighting amongst one another, and Jews are fighting amongst one another. So the whole set of revelations are to clarify how errors have been made, who has gone wrong, and how we can properly understand the history of Israel and of Jesus. Blessed be his name. Okay? And this is the other thing. Muslims are shocked that Christians just simply refer to Jesus and do not immediately venerate his name. And the way they talk with Mary, I mean, do they not know she is the blessed mother of Jesus? Blessed be his name. And so many Muslims, when missionaries come to convert them, are shocked at the lack of respect both for Mary and Jesus. Blessed be his name.
Can I just insert one thing? I'm sorry to stop you, but that very thing, when I went to hear Muslims talk about their religion, and that every time they said Jesus, blessed be his name, I was so impressed with that. I'd never known that. This was a few years ago. And I thought, they respect, you know, my religion. And that's all I needed to know, really. That just hooked me right there.
Yeah. Yeah, but then once you start talking about these things and you hear some of the views, you say, well, wait a minute, how do you get that idea? And a lot of it comes out of Eastern Christianity. And so we're as unfamiliar with our Eastern brothers and sisters and their beliefs as we are with Muslims. So we have a big job. Well, in 622... Then, by 613, then Muhammad began to preach his revelations, and then these revelations began to be handed on and gradually written into the Quran. By 622, he had established power here at Mecca, but was having difficulties with the Jews in the area, and so they went on the Hijra up to Medina, where he established a community with Jews and Christians as part of the Muslim community there, led by Muhammad. Then in the year 630, with 10,000 of his followers, then he came down and conquered Mecca. Okay? So here we have a major difference, that Muhammad is something like a political prophet, Messiah, etc. While Jesus never was a military, political prophet, Messiah. And so here we have another real discomfort that Christians have with Muhammad. He was a military leader. He led successful military campaigns, okay, and established Mecca as the center. And he wanted to establish Mecca as the center because that Mecca is, of course, the place in Islamic tradition and in Eastern Jewish tradition where Ibrahim came and built the altar, and they built the altar on the place where Ibrahim was to sacrifice his son. Okay? And here we could spend some time reading the Hebrew Bible passage. His son, which son was it? His son, his beloved son. Well, the son, his only son, well, the only son Abraham had for 11 years was Ishmael. Then finally, Isaac came. And the Hebrew texts, the Hebrew versions, are such that in the years like 700 and 800, it is not clear if the son is Isaac or Ishmael. Rabbis are arguing which one it is in the East. Okay? But the established Masoretic text that we have is dated 900-950. Prior to the discovery of the Qumran text, the earliest Hebrew manuscripts we had are 900-950. Okay? Now, does that date, is that noticeable to you? That is post-Islam. Okay? And so, in a context where Jewish rabbis are deciding that that son and the reading of the text, the only son, must be the beloved son, Isaac, the natural thing is that Muslims are going to have Ishmael. Okay? Because Islam emerged in the middle of Christianity and Judaism, and Christians are arguing about, well, was Jesus created or not? Could Jesus be created? Well, if Jesus is created, he's a creature. Uh-huh. Well, the Muslims are, well, the Jewish rabbis argue, well, it's the Torah that is uncreated. The Torah existed before creation, then God revealed it. And so for Muslims, what existed prior to creation was the recitation of God's word, the Quran. So the Quran is what was uncreated and then came down to clarify for Jews and Christians who continually are disagreeing with one another among themselves. Christians disagree whether Jesus is, you know, one nature, two nature. They're arguing, and Jews are arguing and disputing with one another. And so Islam receives these revelations that can clarify in the midst of the variations in Hebrew manuscripts where Jews fight about it, variations in the manuscripts for Christians where they fight about whether this is. The Quran is a revelation from God that is the uncreated revelation that clarifies what corruptions came in both to Jewish and Christian manuscript traditions. And you may or may not know, by the time you get down to 1500, 1400, the first printing press, for Christian manuscripts, there are, I don't myself personally, but available to scholars like myself for determining the wording of the New Testament are 4,000 pre-printing press manuscripts, which have variations in them that scholars now estimate to be like 300,000 variations. Now, some of them are present or absent of the article the, some are reversals of words, and some aren't that important. But it does make a difference if it says Jesus is Lord, Jesus is Kyrios, or Jesus is God, Jesus is Theos. And it's issues like that. So Islam is coming into this context of disagreements among Christians, East and West, and even in the East, and disagreements among Jews, or another, and they're receiving revelation to clarify what God really has in mind. Now, as I thought about this, you turn the page, I thought of an interesting comparison. How can we get a concept on 500 years from 70 to 570? Well, wouldn't you know? John Calvin was born in 1509. 500 years later, it will be 2009. Okay? So what if we had a person born in the area of Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, about 2009, and now that person is growing up. Calvin was converted in 1533. So what about if in 2033 now, there was a young man in that eastern area who began to receive revelations from God that would clarify the traditions of Judaism, Catholicism, and Presbyterianism. You know, there were, like I checked with Marilyn Borst, just about the number of Presbyterians in Iraq. You know, there were 750 Presbyterian families living in Iraq, ancient Babylonia, prior to our attacking of Iraq. Now there are 250 families in Iraq. But there was a very strong establishment and presence of Presbyterian Christianity in Iraq, along with Catholics, along with Eastern Orthodox Christians of various kinds, intermixed, intermingled. So what do Christians believe? Okay. And then Jews and Muslims. Now the population is being decreased. But what would...
This is when we attacked them in 2003.
Yeah.
Because we did it before.
That's right. It's the combination. There were about 1.4 to 1.7 million Christians overall in Iraq. There's disagreement as it's hard to get the statistic. And now there's something more like 300,000 to 500,000 total Christians in Iraq. So one of the things that our war on Iraq has done is to significantly destroy almost the Christian population in Iraq. Really, really weaken it and really lower it. So it's one of our wonderful achievements of the 21st century. You know, we're out there in the world doing good things. Okay? So that people don't misunderstand God and things like that. Okay? So, now, interesting thing is, after studying the Quran, biblical tradition in the Quran, intensively for about a year and a half to 2 years after 9/11, along with my colleagues in Middle Eastern Studies. First of all, I had team taught with Gordon Newby in Middle Eastern Studies since 1994, where I was learning about the Quran in Introduction to Sacred Texts. As we were teaching students, we taught Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism in this class from 1994 to about 2005. We don't teach it now for various technical reasons. Just pragmatic. People moving away and not doing things, etc. But about a year and a half to 2 years into studying the Quran, I began to realize, first of all, that the Quran is about exactly the same length as the New Testament. About exactly the same length. Now, it's hard to get a precise word count of Arabic words. It's very difficult. But it's about exactly the same length. And you start to think about it. The New Testament was a new holy corpus and body of work that emerged out of a movement that emerged out of Judaism with a special focus on Messiah. Right? And then the Quran came into being through revelations of a new emerging faith movement in relation to Hebrew Bible and New Testament. Right? So I began realizing that these are both new revelational writings related to the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, of about the same length. And then I began to notice the frequency of references to two biblical people. And all of a sudden, I started really doing some statistical working. And I was amazed to find out that the New Testament and the Quran are in agreement with one another on the most frequently referred to Hebrew Bible person. You see it there on the list, number one? Who is the most frequently referred to Hebrew Bible person, both in the Quran and the New Testament?
Moses.
Yeah. Moses. Whoa. Thought it would be Abraham. But now look at Abraham. Yeah, so Moses is referred to 79 times in the New Testament, 137 in the Quran. Now, Abraham is referred to virtually exactly the same number of times in the Hebrew Bible and the Quran. 71 times in the New Testament, I misspoke, and 69 in the Quran. Now, you can begin to see the separation of the two testaments when you look and you see that David is referred to 60 times in the New Testament, 17 in the Quran, because they're really not interested in a Davidic Messiah prophet. Because Muhammad could be a Davidic Messiah prophet, but Muhammad is way superior to David, etc. So you really don't want David in there. That's a Christian thing, you know. So David is referred to 17 times. David in the Quran is this magnificent writer of the Psalms. He has given the Psalms to the people of the book, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But 60 times, so you can see how David says, namely the Psalms are quoted specifically and referred to David in the New Testament, 17. In contrast, Noah is referred to 8 times in the New Testament, but Noah is referred to 43 times in the Quran. Why? Here we get an insight into the intensity of the Quran. If you don't believe what God says, you can face the kind of destruction that came at the time of Noah. Noah believed. And then the irony is, in the Old Testament, Noah actually speaks 3 verses to his sons. That's all he says. But in the Quran, Noah talks on and on, warns the people that the flood is coming. They won't believe him. He's making his ark. They make fun of him. He says, it's about time you respond. They don't respond. And so there is an intensiveness that I see as an apocalyptic intensiveness in the Quran. It is warning. The warners have come. And you must believe. And if you don't believe, there are dire consequences for people who do not believe. And so Noah is very important in the Quran, referred to 43 times, and Surah number 71 is named Noah. Okay, so it's entirely him. While Noah is referred to only 8 times in the New Testament. The third most frequently cited personage in the Quran and the New Testament where they agree in frequency is Satan. Which again is very, very interesting. Satan is referred to in the Hebrew Bible 2 or 3 times. Satan, Shaitan, is not an important figure in the Hebrew Bible. Now, we may think the serpent is Satan, but the serpent actually is not Satan in the Hebrew Bible. That's the book of Revelation interpreting serpent as Satan. And that's a long topic. But Satan, the one who is that powerful one who can lead people astray, is as strong in the Quran as it is in the New Testament. And there are 2 names for Satan, the Shaitan or Satan, Satanas in the New Testament, but also Diabolos. And in the Quran, that Diabolos is shortened to Iblis. See, if you take the D off, you take the A out, and you take the O out, and you put the I at the end, you get Iblis. The Iblis, the Blis, you know, the Diabolos. Okay, so there are 11 references to Iblis. Now, Mary, you see, in the Quran, is referred to more times in the Quran than in the New Testament, 34 times. And in fact, there's a whole surah, 19, for her. And then Jesus is referred to 25 times in the Quran. One of the reasons Mary is referred to so often is that virtually every time Jesus is referred to in the Quran, he is Jesus, son of Mary. Jesus, son of Mary. Okay? But then Isaac, then Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, Jonah, Elizabeth, Gabriel, Enoch, Samuel, Michael, Elisha, and Hebrew Bible, Saul. So here you see 13 people who occur in the New Testament and the Quran in virtually the same order of frequency. An amazing kind of relationship of the New Testament to the Quran. And when I presented this to my colleague Gordon Newby, I said, this is remarkable. He said, well, you should expect that. I said, why? And I said, you never said that. No, I never did that work. No. But you should expect that, because he said they are emerging out of Christianity and Judaism. I said, well, I didn't know, I didn't know. But that really began to drive me on and energize me concerning study of Quran, New Testament. If we turn to the third page, this Quran, the final testament, is on the web and very readily available in HTML version. You can download it on your own computer, and then in the left column is a reference to the chapters. You just click on the chapters, you can go to it. You can copy and paste it into any kind of thing. I just actually found these toward the end of my work last evening, because these weren't available 8-10 years ago when I was making presentations here. And the other one that's available is this little this is a small version by Khan and Al-Hilali that a young Muslim man gave to me. And I, when I was reading it, I just really love this little version of it. The one that's recommended regularly in scholarly circles is Muhammad Pickthall, and that is available also. But this is really archaic King James version, and it makes it very difficult. One quick thing, see, I always plan too much, but on the last page is a story about Abraham that is in the Quran that they get from Jewish tradition in the East. That is a key story about Abraham, just to show the differences and one of the difficulties. Abraham is clearly a person of faith, the person who believed and became the first real clear Muslim in the Hebrew Bible. Namely, he became submissive totally to God. God told him to go to the land of Canaan, and he went. But at that time, a key thing about Abraham was that he began to believe in the one God who is the creator of heaven and earth. His father, Abraham's father, worshipped idols.
He was an idol maker, wasn't he?
Idol maker. He had many, many idols, and maybe he did make them all, but he went away and made the mistake of leaving Abraham in charge of them. Okay? And this was when Abraham had been encountered by the one God. And so Abraham's father went away for the day and left Abraham in charge of them. And so Abraham smashed all of the idols except the big one. Okay? And then when his father came home, it says, "You broke all my idols." And Abraham said, No. I just put out food for them, and the big idol wanted the food, so he just smashed all the other little items, and he just destroyed them. And Abraham's father said, "That's impossible." Because he says these idols can't do anything, and they can't even speak. And Abraham said, "Well, why do you worship them?" So then they reported him to the city, and then there is a city kind of thing where they brought him up to trial. And so Abraham defended the one God. So Abraham is the first one who became a believer in the one God, maker of heaven and earth, in the history of humankind. Right? So Abraham was a Gentile, you see, who believed the one God. Okay? Now, some Christians are not clear enough about this. Okay? We talk about Abraham believing and being justified by his faith. But do we realize that that means that Abraham became the first true believer in one God,
What's
the Father?
What's this about him being a Gentile?
Well, he's a worshiper of idols. He's an idolater.
Well, nobody's a Jew at that point, I guess.
No, he's not a Jew. No, he's not a Jew. No. He's from the Kali. He's not a Jew. His family worships idols.
Well, were there so identified Jews at that time?
Yeah.
Oh, there were. Well.
Yeah, at the time of Abraham?
Yeah.
Not according to the Quran, I don't think. No. No. I mean, Abraham's before Moses, right? No? No. So, now, the line of prophets actually begins with Adam, who was created, etc. So they are earlier, but the real monotheistic believers is Abraham. He stands at the forefront. And Christians kind of know this, but don't know this. Jews kind of know this, but don't know this. And this is one of the wonderful kinds of things that the Quran is clear about. Right? That Abraham's father, Azar, rather than Terah, it has a different name, was an idolater, worshipped idols, and Abraham stood up against his father and against the leaders of the city and says, "Your God is the God of heaven and earth, not these idols that you are worshipping." So they actually threw Abraham in the fire, but he didn't burn. And so you can go to the place and see where they threw him in the fire, and God saved him from the fire. Okay, so this is the kind of additional revelation that Christians and even Jews may not know. Now, interesting thing was Gordon Newby and I and Lori Patton were teaching a course on to doctoral students, and this became a focus one week, and this Jewish student came back the next week all excited. He says, "Would you believe?" He said, "I went to the synagogue on Friday night, and you know the story they told? They told this story about Abraham breaking the idols of his father, because it's in the Talmud." He said, "I had no idea." You see, yeah.
So that's in the Talmud, but of course it's not in the Old Testament.
It's not in the Old Testament, right. And it's also, you can write it down, it's in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, okay? There is a special Eastern rabbinic tractate called The Sayings of Rabbi Eliezer, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, that has many of these Eastern stories that are being told by rabbis here that are also in the Quran. So really, Islam is a kind of an Eastern kind of Judaism, as well as an Eastern kind of Christianity that it is bringing together. Time at least for a couple of questions. I talked to you all.
Do Muslim scholars today, your counterparts, Muslim scholars, accept all this historical analysis of the origins of Islam? Is that
most Islamic scholars have focused heavily on the relation of Islam to Judaism. Most of them are quite clear about the relation of Islamic tradition to Eastern Judaism. Many are not very clear, and many of them are actually Jewish, or they work together, Jewish and Muslim, and Israeli scholars who are, you know, Muslims and know Muslim traditions, and they are aware of this. But they are not so clear about the relation of these two Christian traditions. They will know that, well, there's some apocryphal gospel there that has Jesus that made little clay birds and brought them to life, but they really, they don't know the name of it, and they're not sure exactly where it is.
Does the Coptic Church fall closer into the Muslim beliefs than the ordinary Christian churches?
Only some. The Coptic Church will use many Ethiopic traditions, and that means they will have First Enoch in their Hebrew Bible, which is filled with apocalypticism. Okay, and intensive understanding of the heavens, an expansive understanding of the heavens, and how demons came into being through when the watchers saw the beautiful maidens on earth and gave birth to the Nephilim in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. But First Enoch interprets this as the beings that came into birth there were half human, half eternal spirit, and then blood and flesh mixed with eternal spirit and became bloodlust, eternal spirit. And so that gave birth to all the demons and unclean spirits that began to go into humans and to pervade the universe. Okay, these were traditions that came into being within Judaism around 200 before BC, 200 BC. And so that's the updated Jewish apocalyptic versions. Now, Ethiopic Christians tend to know that information rather than some of this other information. They're down in Egypt and the Abyssinian Christians there. Yeah.
And we'll have this handout.
Okay.